Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Tom Tugendhat makes a first appearance at the Sydney Institute, and he's very welcome. I should mention that our guest speaker tonight has been brought to Australia by the Australian High Commission in Britain, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, in other words, under its special visits program. Sajid Javid, who gave our annual lecture this year, came out on that program some years ago, and we had him here at the Institute. And it's great to have Mr. Tugendhat here tonight. Now, I'll introduce him very briefly. He's a Conservative MP for Tonbridge and Malling in Kent, a former military intelligence officer, a former special advisor to the UK Chief of Defence, and many other things besides. And you've seen that on the CV that we put out. But let's get on with it. And our speaker tonight's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic Britain, after David Cameron, Brexit, and the Chilcot Report. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, I too am a fan of Fox, so can you hear me okay? Jolly good. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening, and it's a great pleasure to be in Australia. This is my first proper visit to your wonderful continent. I have been here before, I must confess. About 10 years ago, I flew out of Afghanistan, landed in Adelaide, went to a wedding, and the next day I flew back to Afghanistan. I'm not entirely sure that 24 hours at a wedding in Adelaide counts as a full knowledge of Australia, so I really do consider this my first visit to your wonderful country. And it's an absolute privilege to be here this evening. Thank you very much to Gerard and Anne for hosting me this evening at the Sydney Institute. I'm particularly pleased to be here because this is an extraordinary moment, not just for the United Kingdom, but I would argue for Australia too. We have come to a moment of strategic reset, and though the question is Cameron, Brexit and Chilcot, if you don't mind, I'm going to do that classic political thing and answer my own question. But you'll like it because it's Chilcot, Brexit and Cameron. Because actually what I want to talk about is, how did we get here? How did we get to a position where Britain is having the greatest strategic reset moment, possibly since the Second World War, possibly since 1939, if you consider that since 1945 the position was evolutionary and we evolved in many ways into the European Union. This time it isn't an evolution, it's a revolution. And so the question has to be asked, really, how did we get here? So you're quite right, of course, as you always are, to link Chilcot to Brexit. Because Chilcot was the first review, I mean, he took a while, but was the first real review of the Iraq War. And the Iraq War, in many ways, began the level of questioning trust in politicians and political leadership that we've seen evolve in the United Kingdom and around the world into a situation where we've got various different people making very, very different decisions to the ones that they have been encouraged to make by their leadership. Now, in the United Kingdom, the Chilcot Report refers, of course, to very much the Blair moment. And for those of you who've seen the debate on the UK, in the UK Parliament, and for those of you who've seen the analysis or read some of the analysis that's been running for now some months on what Chilcot says, the result won't be any really great surprise. The report says what we all expected. It says that the intelligence was wrong. It says that Tony Blair made a mistake. Whether you think he was culpable or not, Chilcot doesn't actually say. He doesn't actually assign guilt. But he does say that the strategic decision was an error based on false information, based on a failed procedure, based on an unsound government setup. So whichever way you look at it, it comes to a pretty sharp criticism of Her Majesty's British government. And by implication, there are criticisms, of course, of our allies in the United States. It doesn't extend to criticism of your government, but I'm sure there are people here who've read it in various different ways. But that report has really brought together a sum of various moments. It's brought together a sum of various moments that have seen British forces deployed in action in Iraq and Afghanistan in very difficult areas, in areas I served, but in very, very difficult areas. And what it's done is it's effectively looked at the Blair Wars in half. It's chosen to look, for obvious reasons, at the Iraq and Afghanistan operations, and chosen, again, for obvious reasons, not to look at Kosovo or Sierra Leone. It also hasn't looked, of course, because it wasn't tasked to, at things like Rwanda. So it's looked very clearly at the failure of strategic intelligence, the failure of strategy making, and the failure of decision making in the British government. And in doing so, it has challenged the United Kingdom to reinvent itself. But of course, before Britain got the chance to do that, we had a second issue. And that issue was Brexit. Now, many people will know that the promise made by David Cameron in 2013 appeared to be, for domestic political reasons, it appeared to many to be, to solve a problem in the Conservative Party. But I would argue that is a misreading. I would argue that because if you look at the result of the vote, first of all, it demonstrates quite clearly that this wasn't an internal Conservative problem any more than it was an internal Labour problem or an internal anyone else problem. Because the country not only voted out, but in almost every part of the country, with the exception of Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, it was a pretty solid majority. London was an exception as well, but London's exceptionalism is perfectly understandable when you look at the level of migrant community in London and the European element and the way that the profit is made so much from the trade. So you find yourself looking at a United Kingdom that has chosen, in reality, not just to reject the advice of its political leadership, but to reset the strategy that has been the norm, really, since 1973, and in many ways has been the accepted wisdom since the attempts to join under Macmillan. Now, of course, that's quite a stunning moment for us. It's quite a stunning moment because it now starts to ask some very fundamental questions, not just of ourselves, not just of our own government, but actually of our friends and our place in the world. And that's where we come on to the post-Cameron phase, which in many ways has to be our longest phase, forgive me, because, of course, we're all much more interested in the future than we are in the past. Now, our post-Cameron phase revolves around what do we do next? Did Cameron have to go, one can ask. Well, I would argue he did, and I was very pleased that he left with dignity and quickly, rather than having to be prized out of office like some members of other parties in the United Kingdom. I'm very glad that he's also left in such a way that he's allowed the party, yeah, to have a pretty tough fight, actually, over the next leader, but to come together very solidly and quite rightly around Theresa May. I'm personally delighted, as I have supported her since the beginning, but I'm not just delighted that I happen to get this one right. I'm delighted because she is absolutely the right leader of our country at this moment. Now, I don't know how many of you know her or have met her in various other guises, but she's a phenomenal individual. She's a very, very quiet and powerful woman. Her leadership of the Home Office for 6 years, through, let's face it, some of the toughest times for security in the United Kingdom, has been majestic. She's had a very, very steady hand. And when things have been difficult, she hasn't got excitable, she hasn't run to the press. She has run a very organised and well-measured department. And I'm very confident that's exactly what we're going to see carrying through into number 10. Because the real question of all of this, the real question of the strategic reset from the Iraq relationship with the United States and with our own leadership, of Brexit and now Chilcot, is that we've got to ask ourselves as Britons, who are we? Where are we? And who are our friends? And of course, some of those questions haven't changed. Some of those questions are absolutely fundamental to us. You know, we are an island off the north coast of continental Europe. That's not going to change. we are an international community with links across the world, not just here to Australia, but pretty much to every country between here and Australia, or rather between the UK and here. It's very difficult to get used to the fact of where one is. So it is a difficult process to see ourselves in this setting, in this truly global setting, and to ask ourselves, how do we deal with it now? But there are some very, very clear routes for us. And those routes are to reinforce those areas of success. So for us, NATO is a very strong area. You know, your partnership in it is an important element of that. But NATO is hugely important to us. And that's not just because we value enormously the relationship with the United States, which we do. It's not just because we see it as helping to have guaranteed peace in Europe for 70 years, but we do. It's because we see a world that is not stable, that is not peaceful, as a natural order of things. We see a world that requires the efforts of friendly powers, the efforts of willing partners to make peace and to keep it. And in Europe, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to have seen some of the effects that failure has to keep the peace has caused. If you see the first time since 1945 that the borders of Europe were changed by force, you only have to look at Crimea. If you want to look at some actions that, if not war, are definitely warlike, look at the fighting in Donetsk and look at the actions in Georgia. And if you want to see some of the most modern examples of war, look at the cyber attack on Estonia of only a few years ago, which closed down the Estonian government and country for a few days. And though we can't be very certain, sorry, let me rephrase that. Though we can be very certain, we cannot point the finger directly. It's quite clear that these attacks have all come out of Russia. So the idea that NATO, for us, is a historic alliance or simply a nice to have is wrong. It's not. It's an essential for our place in the modern world. But it's not just NATO. We value many other relations. We value absolutely our place in the United Nations. We value the Security Council's work, and we value its influence around the world. We also value Europe. Though we have chosen to leave a treaty arrangement, we have not chosen to reject our friends. We have not chosen to insult or abuse France and Germany and Italy and many other countries that are very, very firm allies. And though we are changing a trading relationship, it's quite clear when you look at the security relationship that we share with many, France on enormous amounts of intelligence and cooperation on cross-border issues, Denmark, integral part of our battle fleets and of our military structures, Estonia likewise, Germany, with whom we have partnerships on everything from finance to engineering. These are very, very serious partnerships for us, and they are of extreme value, and we will defend them and defend that cooperation. But it means that we have the liberty to do what we have forgotten for a while. And that is to reinforce other relationships that really matter to us. And here I come very specifically to Australia. Because while it is true there are many other relationships around the world that are perhaps more financially beneficial to both of us in the sense that they're bigger economies, while there are others that are closer, there are a few that are more natural fits. And this isn't, and I must be quite clear here, this isn't some sort of harking back to empire or 10-pound poms, or whatever you called them back then. This is a very modern evaluation of what we see here today in Australia. Because today there is no mother country. Or rather, there are two. Because each is the mother of the other. If you work in the UK now, you don't have to go very far before you meet an Australian who is running a bank, sitting in a fund, acting as a lawyer, partner in a law firm, fact, one of my best friends from university was a partner, Australian partner at Linklater, so it's an appropriate place to talk about this. You don't have to go very far to see that. And for them, of course, referring to the mother country refers to Australia, and they're bringing the skills to the UK. And of course, here there's about 1 million UK citizens who refer to the mother country the other way round. It's not just even in that. When you look at the way that our nations have grown up, for a long time the traffic was one way, but for a long time now, actually, it's been in reverse. I sit on the Constitutional Affairs Committee of the House of Commons, and some of the questions we're asking ourselves are questions that you would understand very clearly. What is the relationship between Westminster and Edinburgh, between the British government and the Scottish government? How do you share power between London, the mayoralty, and London, the capital? What should we give to Stormont for itself, for Northern Ireland? These questions of devolution are questions that are new to us in many ways, and they're very difficult for us to answer. But there are other questions. What is the role of the Supreme Court? It's only existed since 1999. How should judges act? What should their powers be? And these are difficult questions. These are really hard questions to answer because they're fundamentally questions of culture, of ethics, and of history and tradition. So quite rightly, we look around the world and we ask ourselves, well, how do other people do this? How do Americans do this? Of course, we get some answers, and some of them are valid, and some of them are very different. We can look to Germany, we can look to France. But the reality is, the best lesson we get, the clearest examples we get, are when we learn from Australia, whose Supreme Court and whose federal structure teaches us very clearly and very powerfully how good governance in a parliamentary system, in a federal structure, can work. So today, when I say the mother country, it isn't clear who I mean. In legal terms, I could well mean Australia. In federal terms, I could well mean Australia. So for us this moment, this strategic reset that we have just found ourselves in is actually an opportunity. And it's an opportunity for us to conduct new relationships across the world. It's an opportunity for us to change the way we look so that we're no longer regional but international again. And it's an opportunity not only for British business, which it is, but actually for our friends. So these coming years, certainly in the year 2016, I've been urging people from this country, from Australia, to come to the United Kingdom to help shape our trade policy, to help shape it so that it includes our friends and allies here, to help shape it so that we all prosper from it. Because I'm very, very confident that the next few decades are going to see an extraordinary opening, an extraordinary opportunity. And yeah, some Australian companies will open through London, but many British companies will also open through Sydney and Melbourne and see opportunities here. I'm very confident that this is the beginning of an enhanced relationship. It's not a new relationship because, of course, our relationship is so deep, there is no novelty in it. But it's certainly an enhanced relationship. And the reality is the post-Cameron world has given us an opening that Theresa May, I know, is very ready to exploit, and Britain is very ready to share with her. Thank you.
Many thanks. So we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. Before we start, I should say thanks to Alan's for the use of this fine facility tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. You speak about the importance of NATO to Britain, and that's a point well taken. We hear about a diminishment of British military force. As you know, Britain's still got substantial force, as has France. Not much else in Europe has. Do you believe that in the new, well, NATO's, Britain remains in NATO, but do you believe that there's any reason why Britain should do more or about the same in its military equipment?
Well, it's a very good question. The Strategic Defence Review of a few years ago did reduce the number of combat troops, that's true, and did change the emphasis that we had on ships and air. But let's not undervalue what we've got in the United Kingdom. We're commissioning new Type 45s, we're commissioning new hunter-killer astute submarines, and we just voted about 2 weeks ago on renewing the Trident nuclear deterrent. We also have a much more honed land force that is now integrated better with allies and is geared specifically to partner, which is, let's face it, the way that modern warfare works. And we are indeed doing all of those things. You know, it's quite clear that Britain is today playing a very active role in Poland in extending the NATO envelope to make sure that it's quite clear that we stand by our allies. We've extended the number of aircraft we have in the NATO air policing role over the Baltic states. And we're playing very active roles around the world through our Navy. Now, that's not just a today point. That points to the future as well. Because actually, if you look at our future frigate, the F-26, that is going to be an extraordinarily capable vessel. And, of course, we're going to encourage you to share in its capabilities, because we're going to hope that you look very seriously at buying it. But it's much more than just simply about our own capabilities. When you think about British capabilities, of course you can count men, you can count ships, tanks, and crew. But you've also got to look at what we leverage. We don't do this alone, we do it with you. We leverage a common intelligence framework, we leverage a common strategic understanding in many ways, perhaps in different areas, but certainly a common strategic understanding in a rules-based system, in a system that sees us standing up for what is right in the world. And we also, and this is often missed by many of our fellow citizens, we leverage a strategic depth that we get from each other. Now, that's not geographic. The one thing you don't need in Australia is strategic depth geographically. You have plenty of that. But what you do get from your partnership with us, from your familial relationship with us, is you get a strategic depth in human capital. And that human capital sees Royal Naval officers and sailors on Collins class today and on whatever they're called in a few years' time. It sees British liaison officers not acting as liaison officers, but actually embedded into military structures in Australia. And it sees, in my case, an Australian who was supposedly on attachment to my unit taking command of it during the war in 2003. And that human strategic depth is a phenomenal asset to both countries and enriches us both.
Thank you very much. You have very much enjoyed the talk, particularly certain aspects. And one of them was you talked about we, as we British. We, you, NATO, Europe, and so forth, us, Eastern Bloc. It seems to me that you somehow speak as if it was one nation, whereas it seems from the outside, the mentioned question of the two nations came back, and now what we see is actually two lots of people not sharing one thought, one idea, probably apart from being British, but certainly not of the future,
not
of the present.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile these increasing hate crimes?
Okay, we're not going to pick all this up. So the suggestion is there are actually two nations in Britain, not one nation, and this is envisaged, this can be demonstrated by the existence of hate crimes, etc. Okay.
Well, I think the question you ask is the question that Theresa May sought to answer in her very first speech. You know, when Theresa May spoke about union, she wasn't just talking about the union between England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. She was talking about the union of our nation and very much one nation conservatism, and that derives, I should be quite clear, from Benjamin Disraeli and not from Pauline Hanson. What she was saying was that you're right, there is division within our country. There are people who have lost out. There are people in quantitative easing, as you know, have seen asset prices rocket but salaries fall. And these problems are real, and I certainly don't deny them. But there are opportunities to fix them. And the opportunities to fix them demand the kind of leadership that Theresa May is absolutely ready to give. That's why she started with that very powerful speech on the steps of Downing Street only a few weeks ago. Because actually by addressing not just the inclusion in terms of economic inclusion, but the inclusion in terms of educational opportunity, in terms of communities across the country, in terms of opportunity for employment, to start businesses. What she's talking about is exactly what you're talking about. It's how do we break down that gap. But I would argue, and I argue it quite strongly, yeah, there are problems. And yes, there are communities that feel disadvantaged and left out. But broadly speaking, the United Kingdom is still united. Yes, there are problems. Of course there are. But if you look across the United Kingdom, you do not see the hate crimes in such numbers that people talk about in other parts of the world. You do see a problem, of course you do. But it isn't a divided nation, as you see so many around the world. And even when my friend Joe Cox was murdered a few weeks ago only, it feels like a lifetime, but it was only a few weeks ago. It's worth remembering that although the pain echoed in the country, and we all felt it, and in communities across our country, services, memorials were organised by people who'd never met her, by people who didn't know her. What you didn't see was echoes of the violence. You didn't see any copycats. You didn't see anybody saying that was reasonable. That you didn't see. What you saw instead was a nation coming together in grief and shock at one man's action, not at a wider thing.
Greg.
Thank you for that very powerful statement you just made about Jamie Cox. I wondered if you could briefly comment on the position that Europe seems to be taking, that they won't provide issues so that you can't have free trade access without other parts of the package, particularly immigration. And while that wasn't the only issue, of course, that was clearly a powerful thing. Do you see that being broken down? So that eventually free trade access, more like what was there before the treaties, as part of the settlement with Europe, or do you think that was going to go before the treaties? Or is it all too hard to ask?
So I'm not going to teach an Australian how to do a trade negotiation. You guys have been doing it for years and remarkably successfully in Japan and China and Korea. You know that you start off hardball. You know that you lay some very difficult cards on the table. And then you start talking. And look, France has got problems today. It's got real problems. It's got its election next year, it's got real division in its society, and it's fighting the most unpleasant domestic terrorist campaign. So you know what? They're not really in the mood to start sounding generous now. Germany likewise has got an election coming next year. The Dutch have got Geert Wilders and the threat of further trouble. I mean, you can run around Europe and you can find a whole series of areas. I mean, even in Italy, the mayor of Rome, Virginia Raggi, has made some particularly difficult statements for Renzi, talking about leaving the European Union, talking about how the country should be run. So, you know, we've got a European continent that has got a few other things on its plate right now. So it's not really surprising that when Juncker hires a negotiator and he goes to Barnier, we end up with a conversation that isn't perhaps the most helpful. But I would suggest quite strongly that, as you know very well, trade negotiations are remarkably non-emotional. And the Americans teach us this. Whenever we go to war with them, we find out that they've decided not to buy our beef. So it's not about emotion. It's about hard facts. And the reality is, we do a lot of trade together. Of course it would be bad for us if we didn't get a free trade deal. But it would be bad for them too. And they know that too. So we will get something. I don't know what it'll be. I'm not going to tell you what the shape of it will be. But we will get, I'm sure, a very good deal. And the good deal will be good for our friends and it'll be good for us.
So, question. Hang on a second. We'll go over here. And then we'll come up here. Go over there. Yeah. Speaking to the microphone, okay?
Brexit was about the people rising up against EU control over Britain, especially on the immigration issue. Isn't it time we also investigate the UN? Because it also interferes with the affairs of sovereign nations.
Well, I'm delighted you know with such clarity what the vote was about. I've spent a month trying to work it out, but I bow to your superior knowledge. It's a very difficult question. It is a very difficult question, because actually the answer is, yes, of course it was about the EU and migration. But it wasn't for Dan Hannan or Douglas Carswell. For them, it was about the freedom to choose. For Douglas Carswell, it was more about libertarian migration too. He was quite happy with that, as he's made the case before. So depending on who you are, Brexit was about many different things. But you're right, migration played a part. The perception of lack of control played a part. So yeah, sure, it was about that. But you've got to look around the world and ask yourself, do you believe in rules-based economies? Do you believe that the principles that apply to you should apply to others? Or do you believe that simply we should govern ourselves through some form of control and may the devil take the hindmost? Well, I think if you come from a common law tradition, as you guys do, you have an idea of some form of equality and some form of basic jurisdiction. And I think in that, the UN has a very important role. Not as a court, which it very rarely acts as, but as a forum for discussion. I mean, the idea that we shouldn't talk to each other, I find quite difficult. And so I would argue very much that the UN still has a very active role.
G'day. I just got back from a trip to Britain, and what I
Speak into it.
Very rarely is all I talk to by Jack Lowen's line. I've just got back from a trip to Britain, and the thing that most distressed me, I've got to say, from the point of view of looking at how the Brexit has been handled, was the issue of the 3 million odd European migrants in the UK. And I spent a lot of time in London, I encountered quite a few of them, and what really struck me was it's not been well handled. One of the few things I thought Andrea Leadsom got right was she immediately said, that the 3 million can stay, whereas I've seen nothing the same coming from through. Maybe I'm out of touch now, but surely the thing that struck me is that Britain would not work without the 3 million. Some people in the north may complain about them. The country wouldn't work without them. Isn't it time to try and make sure you keep those people you need so desperately, rather than have them drift away scared? A lot of them are scared.
Okay.
So look. The question about migration came up in the vote, as you know, and as the gentleman behind you mentioned. And it wouldn't be right for us to ignore the clear expression. So turning around and saying we're going to fix the terms of trade, as we were talking about before we get to the table, would be absurd. But it would also be absurd for us to start off with the premise that they're going to be expelled from the country. They're not. There is simply no way that we... And Her Majesty's government has made it, sorry, Her Majesty's British government has made it absolutely clear that that's simply not on the table. Theresa May has made it clear, David Cameron made it clear before he retired. And there's absolutely no way that we're going to put it on the table. But the idea that we can promise something without knowing what the European Union is going to turn around and do to the 2 million Brits who are resident in Europe is also absurd. We can't possibly offer a one-way deal. What we're saying, and what we've said very clearly, and Theresa May has been absolutely clear about and said so several times, is for us, that is not a point of negotiation.
John.
You made reference to Australia's political model, how it evolved to the structure here. Are there conversations in Britain where you don't have a written constitution towards forming a written constitution which involves conversations with Scotland and Wales and Ireland to join a written constitutional federation?
No, bluntly. We look at our constitution as a living document and it evolves through legal precedent and it evolves through changes in acts of parliament and judicial decisions. So, I mean, though you're right, we don't have a written constitution, we do have a constitution, it's just structured in a different way. And it allows us, I would argue, it allows us the flexibility that we're now seeing with things like Devo Manx, you know, the devolution of areas in Manchester. Two areas of Manchester, sorry. So I would argue that it, not only we're not talking about it, I'm not terribly interested in talking about it.
On the question of Brexit and what's ahead, I understand that there's a 2-year limit on the negotiations, but I also realise it's never happened before. So to what extent is this whole situation and what comes out of it a sort of a new living thing? I mean, almost a rebirth for Britain as well as Europe, in the sense that some of the regulations that are laid down, which have never been done before, may go by the wayside as you work through the detail. I mean, will it be a 2-year thing? Will 27 nations have to agree? Will Germany and France lead the way and make the others fall in line? I know we don't know this, but what elasticity is there in what comes out of this and how this is going to be approached?
Well, it's worth remembering that there is a 2-year limit to negotiations, but only once you've started them. We haven't started them yet, and we don't have to start them until the Prime Minister writes to the President of President Tusk and invokes Article 50. Now, I don't know when we're going to do it. The Prime Minister has said not this year. She presumably is working with a team to work out the best time to do it. But I suggest that what she's going to be doing is she's going to be thinking very hard about how to get the best deal, not only for the United Kingdom, although, of course, that's the priority, but also for our neighbours. We're not looking to damage them. We're certainly not looking to hurt them. We're looking to change our relationship with them. So what we need now is we need a cooperative dialogue as soon as possible so that we can start the 2-year process and perhaps even end it the next day. If we have got to a situation where everything is pre-agreed, so that we start and stop in 24 hours, that would be a possibility. Now, I don't know if that's likely. I'm not a trade negotiator for the government. But there are many, many areas to be explored here, and you're absolutely right. There's a lot to discuss.
Dimitri, then we'll come over here. Yeah. Where's the mic? Dimitri, just start.
Before the commencement of the Iraq War, I don't know if you coined it, Colin Powell made reference to it, breaking your border. Yet, out of this US election, there's a tendency for the US to pull closer to home, or in, perhaps in Hillary Clinton's case, more towards Asia, their American, their Asian turn, I forget the expression.
Pivot to Asia.
Pivot, yes. Yet, Europe is paying a disproportionate cost for what's happened in the Middle East. Do you have any thoughts about, what foreign policy post-January 20 next year might look like and how it might affect Europe and the United Kingdom?
Well, if you can tell me who's going to win, I'll tell you how I think it's going to go. I think it's worth remembering that the United States is a very stable constitutional system based on 200 years of legal precedent and tradition. Whoever becomes President of the United States is going to wake up in the morning and find that Congress has a view, the Supreme Court has a view, the various military and security institutions have a view, the Department of Commerce has a view. And many of these views won't change from the 19th to the 20th. Many of these views will be constant. So I know we've heard Mr. Trump referring to NATO as obsolete, and I know we've heard various people focusing on one area of the world rather than another. But I suspect we're going to see much more continuity than some suggest. I mean, you know the expression that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Well, the poetry has certainly been florid. I just hope that the prose is fluent. Because what we're looking at is a United States that we all value. We all value very greatly. And we don't just value the United States for its military power, although that is important to all of us. And we don't value it just for its economic power, although that also matters. We value it because the US engagement in the world has been a force for good since the end of the Second World War. Yeah, there are moments, okay? I mean, we can all pick out moments that we wish hadn't happened. But, you know, it's very hard from a British perspective to go around pointing fingers at an American without feeling that one has to apologise for an awful lot of other things too.
Just before we go to Carol, talking about florid speeches, give us a take on Boris Johnson.
The nice thing about Boris Johnson is everybody knows who he is. So, you know, he walks into a room and people listen. They may not always hear what they wanted to hear, but they do listen. And if you need a prime ambassador, if you need somebody who's going to bring people together, if you need somebody who's going to be able to make Her Majesty's British government's position clearly, you know, he can do it. He really can do it. And he's got a hell of a job, because actually there are three jobs now in the Foreign Office in some ways. There's today, which is reassure our friends. And that's the Foreign Office's job, and that's Boris's job. There's tomorrow, and that's the Brexit deal and how it shapes out and what does that mean. And that's David's job, David Davis. And then there's next week, and that's how do we rebuild, or rather, how do we build new relationships, new in-depth trade with our friends and allies. And that's Liam's job. Liam Fox is going to do that, or rather is doing that. And between the three of them, they're going to make a very powerful team. Because they do bring different skills. They're very different people. Boris is, as you rightly identify, a showman, an entertainer, a charmer in many ways. They're not for everyone. David Davis is a very detailed man. He's got a very logical mind, and he's worked through much of the details on Brexit over the last 5 or 10 years. And if you've had the privilege of sitting next to him on the green benches, you may have heard the detail, the deep, deep detail in which he can speak about these things. And Liam is a natural salesman. I mean, he may be a medical doctor, but my God, he really knows what's great about the United Kingdom and what's great about our relationships, and he really can get out there and sell. And he's already been doing it in the United States, and he's done a little bit in Canada, and I firmly expect to see him here in Australia very soon, because I know that those relationships, and I would argue first amongst them Australia, are the relationships he's looking to establish very early to be the platform from which we build to others and to many of our other friends around the world.
Carol.
You're very right in giving a British perspective on Brexit. But another alternative approach is to say that if Brexit voting had taken place 10 years ago, if the US election had taken place 10 years ago, before the GFC, both of them are likely to have quite different outcomes. And the argument would be that slow economic growth has meant that the people that didn't share the benefits of the 3 decades of globalization are now pushing back against the establishment and are looking for comfort in the things that they thought would be right some time ago. So the question I would put to you is if there's a common global force that the redistribution of the benefits of globalization haven't worked and those people that have suffered are pushing back against the establishment, does Britain need to think more broadly? Because the consequences that we're seeing in the United States, and I think we're seeing in Australia, and we'll see elsewhere, is much more inward-looking domestic economies, much more protectionism, much more policy directed towards appeasing those people that will hurt you out. And unless you think of the Brexit negotiations in terms of a world that is becoming more protectionist, you may find yourself feeling upstream.
I think that's an interesting point. I'm not sure I agree with it fully. there is always a danger in times of economic stress that people think about protectionism, and certainly if you look around the world today, there are many people who are talking in that way, and I accept that point. But the lessons of protectionism are very, very clear. You know, we don't need to look back a full century, only about 80 years, to see what protectionism costs. And it costs first to the population which seeks to be protectionist. So you're right, we've got to explain and remind people what the benefits of globalisation are, because many people, quite rightly and quite understandably, look around and they say, the top have got richer and what have I got? And I understand that. And that's where we domestically have got to look at our social policies, so that we do really have an inclusive policy. And that's why I'm very proud that the Prime Minister has already spoken about things like executive pay and workers on boards. Because those aren't issues for some sort of neo-Trotskyite. Those are issues for people who value capitalism, who understand that capitalism is the best way to liberate human beings. It is the best way to empower people, to empower innovation. And that, yes, there have been problems with banks. It's absolutely true there have been problems with banks. But banks have a moral role. And if they can remember they have it, as the Barclays did when they were Quaker founders way back in the 1700s, or the Lloyds did, who were Reformed Christians, then you start to see that actually banking, by allowing young people to buy homes that otherwise they couldn't afford to buy until they were 60, by allowing young people to save for pensions that otherwise they couldn't have, you see that capitalism does have a role. You see that corporations have a role in allowing people to plan for the future, in allowing people to be confident they can put bread on the table, pay for their kids' education in 10 years' time. So you're right, we have got to get that balance right. We've got to remind people, not just that globalisation matters, but we've got to reset the capital economy. And that's exactly what the Prime Minister's doing. That's why her comments on union were so important, because that's what she was talking about. But we've also got to, you're absolutely right, talk about the world in a way that brings it home. Because so many people look at jobs and say, well, if I had that, you know, if so-and-so wasn't here, I'd have a better paid job. And what they don't say is without globalisation, that TV would cost $5,000. What they don't say is without globalisation, I wouldn't be able to go on holiday for a week with my family. Because actually, the net benefits of globalisation have accrued to everybody. We have all got better off from it. Much, much better off. So now what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that we domestically reset and don't take the wrong lessons.
Related to that question, what we've seen over the Western world now for some time is a splintering of the centre and a splintering of the vote of traditional parties because of many of the things you're talking about. With the Brexit vote, is there now an opportunity for the Conservative Party to bring back into the fold the UKIP, a lot of the UKIP members who have broken on some of these things? Similarly, or alternatively, with the Labour Party going into another election and the parliamentary party so different to a lot of its base, is there now a chance in England that the Labour Party will split?
Those are very interesting questions, and I'm afraid they're very difficult to answer, because of course it's not the Conservative Party that decides whether or not to absorb UKIP. It's UKIP members who decide whether or not to leave UKIP, and then secondly whether or not they decide to join the Conservative Party. And I can't tell you what they're going to do, because people joined UKIP for 1,000 different reasons. Similarly, I'm not an expert on internal Labour politics. I have to say I find it very sad that a party that for the past 100 years has mostly honourably and mostly with integrity represented many people in the United Kingdom has found itself in this state. But parties in opposition go through difficult times. They find it difficult to remember who they are and who they represent. And it's not always the best time to judge them, because parties do re-emerge and do change who they are and sometimes come back. But I think the more interesting question, if you'll forgive me, sir, is your first one, which is about the division in parties. And I would argue that there is a problem that we've had in the West, which is that the accepted norm the centrality, the centralism, if you like, the central nature of liberalism in the middle, has been so acceptable, so normal, so standard, that many people haven't seen the need in politics. Yeah, sure, they've turned up and voted once every 4 or 5 years or 3 years here. But broadly speaking, politics has sort of continued on a perfectly happy trend. And, you know, the candidates are fine, the policies are basically fine in one of the parties, so I can reasonably pick one or the other. The interesting thing that we're seeing today is that for many people, that's not how they see the parties now. They see different parties in different ways. Some people are angry with my party for the Brexit vote. Some people are angry with Labour for the neo-Trotskyite leadership that appears to have taken over. And they're angry, quite rightly, because they say, hang on a minute, this is my party. I may not have joined it, but I voted for it for many years. I may not have gone to its policy conferences, but I've agreed with the areas it's been talking about. And so what you're seeing actually today, which is quite interesting, you're seeing it in the Conservative Party today very clearly, is people joining again. And they're joining because they realise that the accepted liberal settlement, if you like, that we've seen for so long, is something worth fighting for, something worth arguing for. And it's important that we remember that, because of course, people often think democracy is something we do once every 3 or 4 or 5 years. But it isn't. Democracy is what we do when we shape the policies. Democracy is what we do when we write to our representatives. It's what we do when we stand as candidates or pick others to do it. Democracy is a process that we engage in, that we are part of. Democracy is not something that is done to us. It's something that we do together. And if we don't, we find ourselves in a very difficult world. So not only am I absolutely delighted with the renewal of membership in the Conservative Party, I'm actually delighted with the renewal of membership in the Liberal Democrat and Labour and Green parties too. Because of course I would rather people agreed with me. Of course I would. I wouldn't be human if I didn't. Of course I would rather that people shared my values of liberty, of trust in the population. I mean, of course those things matter to me, and of course that's what I want to promote. But I think it's much, much more important in a country like the United Kingdom or like Australia that demands popular engagement with democracy, that people join political parties, whichever political party they are, and shape them so that the options they get every 3 years here or every 5 years for us are options that they want and not options that they're forced to choose because they didn't engage for the intervening period.
I think this will be the final question, Alexander.
Tom, my question is in relation to the Chilcot part of your topic tonight. Do you consider it, or would others consider it now, to be unconstitutional for a British Prime Minister to deploy British forces in military action without reference to a vote in the House of Commons? And in the event that a Prime Minister with a small majority wants to do that, such as Theresa May has now and David Cameron had before, would that small majority or the risk of losing a vote in the Commons materially, in your view, affect the ability of a British Prime Minister to project force if deemed necessary overseas?
There are many reasons I'm pleased that Theresa May is our Prime Minister, and this is one of them. She has a hell of a moral compass. And if she decides it's the right thing to do, she'll do it, and she'll make the argument in Parliament. But yes, you're right, there is a precedent set by Tony Blair, that before deploying force, you talk to Parliament. You get consent of Parliament. Now, personally, I think there are problems with that. You cannot, and you simply can't share the most secret information with 650 people, some of whom used to be journalists. You've got to find ways of sharing it in ways so that you can get a proper understanding of the strategic evaluation, but without compromising either the surprise element of a military action or perhaps sources or other things. So it is a difficult answer. How do you deploy force in the modern world? But the answer has to come down to do the right thing. If it is an emergency, if you must act quickly, Crown prerogative still exists and the executive can act. Sure, it would be expected to come very quickly back to Parliament. I don't know whether that would be immediately or certainly within a few days, to explain itself. And I think that's right. I think that's democratic accountability. If it's not an emergency, if the deployment is going to be, for example, Iraq-like, then I'm not sure I think that it's always wrong that you are forced to explain yourself. Now, how you do it, as I say, has got to be thought very hard, because you can't have dodgy dossiers or edited intelligence briefings. But, you know, we do have structures, as you do, for sharing information and secret information across party, and they can be used properly. So I'm actually pretty confident that we're going to come through this and find the right answer. And I'm particularly confident with Theresa May as Prime Minister.
I think that's a nice spot to end it on, so thank you very much. Well, as we all know, lots of events have occurred in Britain in recent months, so it's great to have Tom Tugendhat here tonight talking about them in a very coherent and logical and informative manner. And I think it's your first substantial visit to Australia. I'm sure there'll be others in the future. And at any rate, a wedding in Adelaide is not a bad start. So this is pretty good. The second one is more substantial. So thanks for coming along tonight, giving your particularly in your ideas of Theresa May, because a new Prime Minister, an important figure in the world, and particularly to Australia. So plus your other analysis on the Chilcot report, on the implications of Brexit, and on just what's going on in modern Britain. So well done. Thank you, and we'll have you back sometime. And thanks to DFAT for bringing you out and for Ellen for putting this on tonight. Thank you. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.